Vatican Cardinal Gerhard Mueller is accused of financial impropriety by a Catholic publication. He joins us exclusively to respond. As tensions rise between Israel and Iran, is the region headed for an all-out war? Newsmax contributor and foreign policy expert Dr. Waleed Faraz is here with analysis. And we'll talk presidential politics and the educational record of Minnesota Governor Tim Walz with former U.S. Secretary of Education Betsy DeVos. And the chaotic U.S. economy remains a top concern this election year. Is a recession coming? Ave Maria Fund manager George Schwartz returns with his take. Finally, the Pope has replaced retiring Archbishop of Boston, Cardinal Sean O'Malley, with Bishop Richard Henning. Editor of Catholic World News, Philip Lawler, will give us the latest on the new Archbishop. The world over begins right now.
Now, Raymond DeRoy.
A warm welcome to all of you joining us in the United States and the world over. If you'd like to comment on tonight's show, send me an X post. I'm at Raymond Arroyo. Lots to cover tonight. First, some troubling news. At least 13 priests, deacons, and religious have been illegally detained by the Ortega regime in Nicaragua since August 1st. This follows the exile of 34 priests from Nicaragua last year. The Ortega regime has been systematically persecuting the church there, including stripping legal rights from 419 civic organizations, many of them Catholic. The Vatican has been largely silent regarding this persecution. We will keep our eyes on it, but it's a glaring example of what happens when communists come to power and how they approach the church and freedom in general. Last week, a Catholic periodical published a story alleging that my next guest was removed from leadership at the Vatican's doctrinal office due to what they called significant financial improprieties, suggesting that he himself may have been guilty of financial malfeasance. It has been nearly 9 years since Cardinal Gerhard Mueller left that post. Here to respond to this story and the allegations made is theologian and former head of the Vatican's doctrinal office, Cardinal Gerhard Mueller. Your Eminence, thank you for being here. First of all, what was your reaction when you saw this July 31st report by The Pillar? What do you make of the timing? Why do you think it's being released now?
That first is more a Hollywood comedy. Because all this story is 9 years ago, and all was clarified with Cardinal Pell, and there were no accusation against myself. And I came to Rome and with the Pope Benedict. He asked me to lead the congregation because as an expert of theology and nothing to do with finance, I didn't come to Rome to make money as a German bishop and as a priest. We have our livelihood and the rest of our money for giving, making charity and not making money to become a rich man.
Your Eminence, the authors of this Pillar article, and there is no byline, so we don't know who actually wrote it, suggest your departure from the doctrinal office at the Vatican, the CDF, was related to financial inconsistencies while you led that office, which led to Cardinal Pell investigating the matter. What did they discover? The Pillar alleges that there were bags of cash all over the congregation. Did you see that?
There was cash in the hands of our administrator, like I said, but was not taken money away from the congregation in private pockets, and that is a point. And they cannot give no proof that was any disappearing of money. On the contrary, I had some sponsors who made a very long table for with 30 seats and chairs for our great meetings. And therefore, what I could do, I helped for the congregation, and nobody, at least not the prefect, took away one penny. And this was, everybody was absolutely gratified with the Cardinal Pell. I had a very, very good relation.
Mm-hmm.
And the ending of my being there as prefect has nothing to do with this questions, and nobody, the Pope himself, didn't tell me what was the reason for the ending of this and nobody knows, and until now nobody knows. And but he appointed me the member for the synod and other things. And the cardinal priest, as a deacon, were promoted from him to cardinal priest. They have no arguments against my theology, and therefore they want to disavow or make defamation of my person.
The Pillar article also alleges, Your Eminence, that a large sum of money, 200,000 euros, was moved to what the article describes as your personal account from the main CDF account prior to the Vatican's financial investigation. Your Eminence, what actually transpired with this alleged transaction? Was your personal account or your CDF account enriched?
Was not my personal account in the Vatican Bank, but there was an account for the mission and for some money the people gave to me for some question of mission and so. And in one way, our administrator moved the money there. But it was absolutely clear that it's the money of the congregation and not my personal money, was under responsibility of the prefect in my function as prefect, and not in a private way.
It was really not your personal account. It was a CDF account.
Yeah, it was an account, and our administrator took this account was for the mission, for some for money coming in. For helping, and he said we can take this account in the service of the congregation. It all was documented that this was no money for my private use. I don't need money for buying aftershave or anything or a car, and so.
Yeah, that would have bought you a lot of aftershave, Your Eminence. 200,000 euros, but look,
yes.
I want to clarify this. The Pillar story also alleges, and it's really the heart of their article, that Pope Francis instructed you personally to repay hundreds of thousands of euros. Is that true? And was there any money missing from the CDF account at the time?
Well, no money missing, and the Pope was not involved, and all was clarified with the Cardinal Pell.
Ah, so he did not instruct you to return any monies?
No way.
Your Eminence, you've been very vocal and forthright in defending Catholic traditional teachings throughout Pope Francis's pontificate. Do you feel that this financial story is a latter-day justification for your being the decision to remove you from your duties at the CDF? Are there individuals trying to cover their tracks, if you will, and make this the reason that you were dismissed?
Does everyone find a reason? Because this was not explainable, and nobody understand it. Why? At least Pope Benedict, he asked me to come to Rome, and after 5 years, this was stopped, and he himself didn't understand why. Nobody did understand why. And therefore, some people are looking for some reasons, but the Pope never make a declaration or explanation why he acted so. Yeah, but I'm what's not the only prefect or high official of the Holy See, who was the Roman Curia, who was removed and then stopped and finished, and a lot of other cardinals in these days. I said only 5 years you should be there, but Other people, they will remain until 80 years, and other people are removed after 5 years. I don't know why.
Yeah. Well, I remember at the time you told me the Pope gave you no reason for the removal. He didn't furnish you
No.
with a reason. And I need to get into this. The pillar also seems to suggest that you only became a critic of some of the views espoused and promoted by Pope Francis after your departure from the CDF, after these financial irregularities allegedly were discovered. But in fact, you raised objection to several initiatives at the Synod on the Family before your departure in 2017, correct?
I never criticized the popes personally, but when I was asked for the Catholic doctrine, I gave the explanation. That is was my mission to explain, and the prefect and me as the theologian, long time professor of theology, I can explain the Catholic faith. And I'm not only the voice of the superior. I must be, I am responsible, and every bishop is responsible in his conscience to give the and to explain the right and orthodox Catholic doctrine. Our first interview was about the demising of three very excellent officials. Some years ago,
Yes.
and I didn't criticize the decision of the Pope to demiss them, but when there came out some arguments that these people had done anything wrong, I had the responsibility to say and to save their good name, and I had to say they didn't do anything wrong, and they was qualified. And I remain in this position until today. They was very qualified, and I don't know the reason why they were dismissed. But there was, according to my judgment, they didn't nothing wrong.
Your Eminence, do you feel that this entire episode and this dredging up of allegations from 9 years ago that seem to have already been settled, is this done with intent?
Yeah, surely it was a certain intention, because 9 years before was all these things was also in the press, but was internal procedures, and nobody were allowed to give it to publicly to the press and to the media. And now, after 9 years, they are redoing it, repeating this strategy of defamation. It's only defamation strategy. It's no new information. Nothing changed in the facts of 9 years ago, and this only reason is make a defamation.
Okay, but my question is, why now? If nothing illegal occurred at the CDF, if no funds were found to be missing, why do you think the pillar chose to run this story now, 2 months before the start of the Synod on Synodality?
Synod of beginning in 2 months surely has anything to do with it. And I made one day, I think before this was coming out, this article, or some days before, I made a very strong statement against the blasphemy in Paris in the Olympic Games, and could be a revenge in this way. I don't know who is behind it, because this was an anonymous strategy. And I asked me if these people have nothing to do in their working time to arrange strategies of defamation instead of doing their work for the church.
But look, I knew Cardinal Pell very well, and I knew him enough that he would not be fraternizing with people who had engaged in financial impropriety. And I know you and Cardinal Pell were very close. So I've also done some calls since I saw this story break, and it seems some of these stories are being embellished a bit, and that a lot of the loose finances were in place long before you arrived at the CDF. But the point is, there was no missing money. Nothing was taken. And that is the heart of this, and made my hackles go up when I first read it. I'll give you the final word.
Other things, protecting the faith and promoting the faith. And I was not an official in the Vatican Bank, but the prefect of the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith. And that was the reason why I came to Rome and why Cardinal, the Pope Benedict, made me his successor.
Your Eminence, Cardinal Gerhard Mueller, I thank you for your time, and we will be in touch.
Thank you very much.
Ever since the October 7th Hamas assault on Israel, the Middle East has been in turmoil. Two recent assassinations carried out by Israel in Beirut and Tehran have expanded the conflict to include Hezbollah and Iran itself. Will these escalations culminate in an all-out war? Joining me now with analysis, Newsmax contributor, author of Iran, an Imperialist Republic and U.S. Policy, Dr. Waleed Fares. Doctor, thank you for being with us. We saw these targeted strikes by Israel in Lebanon and Iran following the October 7th attack. This has really taken things to a new level. What do you see happening next? And is an expansion of Israel's war inevitable?
Yes, it is already a war, a global war in the region, which was started actually by Hamas, being ordered by the Islamic regime in Tehran, being expanded into Syria and Iraq, where those militias are operating, being further expanded to Lebanon, which is controlled by Hezbollah, second front in importance after Gaza. And obviously, as we all learned over the past few months, that the Houthis in Yemen are part of it. So there is that war. What is happening now is in altitude. Most of this war is about basically Air Force, Israeli Air Force, and Israeli countermeasures against targets on the ground or rockets and missiles, including ballistics, hitting Israel. What has changed is now the Israelis are targeting leaders, so it's still in the air, higher-level leaders, and that has created an era of indecision for the command in Tehran. They don't know really what to do because they don't have the skills or the technology of the Israelis to do eliminations inside Israel. But on the other hand, they know if they start their ballistic warfare, especially against civilians, the Israelis, Netanyahu told them, I'll destroy infrastructure.
He said he'd destroy their nuclear arsenal. You think that's a possibility?
Well, first of all, whatever is industrial, like the production, enrichment of uranium, yes, they can. What is about underground infrastructure for ramps, that is something we don't know about, but Israelis, I am sure, in consultation with other allies, know how to do it. But I have another theory. I published an article yesterday, actually, in The Independent in Britain, in which I conclude that in addition to the weaponization, meaning they are buying missiles, the Islamic regime is buying missiles, you know, that, by the way, Raymond, with the money that this administration has...
The $1 billion we've given them over the nuclear deal.
We are giving them open credit to buy, from the nuclear deal. You and I have discussed it for the last 10 years. But what could happen, another scenario, very dangerous, I'm sure all intelligence services in the West are most likely aware of it. That's the Iran regime, Islamic regime, can buy tactical nukes. North Korea, Central Asia, etc. Now, when they buy them, smuggling them into Iran is very different from having big trucks or having big, or our own airplanes. The Israelis will take care of that. And what the regime may do is to deploy them not just inside Iran and then put them on drones, but also to their allies. That's Hezbollah, Houthis, and others. Mm-hmm. I am pretty sure that the U.S. and Israel knows about that. That's very difficult to counter. But it's difficult also on the regime to use them because at this point in time, they're making money. They are extracting billion after billion from Washington, from Brussels. If they go the game of tactical nukes, we are on a different planet at this point.
Wow. But you do see this conflict expanding and Iran responding in some fashion here. It's not a matter of if, but when.
There is no if. The if is gone. They're going to do it. The difference is that what is it that they're going to do? Because they are chess players. The Israelis are chess players, both of them. Mm-hmm. So Tehran is thinking, if I hit across Israel and hit civilians, the Israelis are going to take out my nuclear system and maybe more. You know, Israel has the ability, even without the help of neither the United States nor the Arabs, of hitting the headquarters of the Iranian Revolutionary Guard. That's a different story. Because what could happen, Raymond, and let me break that news here on this show, if Israel decides to go after the actual militia that controls Iran,
yeah.
nobody guarantees the mullah, the ayatollahs, that there will be no revolution or at least uprising inside it.
Mm. So it's a dangerous move for them. It's a dangerous play either way. Look, this week, Iranian authorities, speaking of dangerous moves, waged a mass execution of at least 29 political prisoners on Wednesday. Waleed, what was the purpose of this barbarous act, and who were these prisoners?
Wonderful question. The mainstream media is not even barely talking about it. I mean, we know that.
Yeah.
So I would reverse it for our audience. I'd say this. Initially, the regime, the Islamist regime, has ordered Hamas to attack Israel and perpetrate actually a mini genocide for the purpose of doing three things. Then the third one is what you're talking about. Number one, break any Arab rapprochement between Israel and Saudi Arabia. We spoke of. Number two, force the United States to withdraw its bases from Syria, Iraq. But number three, the most dangerous, it is most likely that this action to bring all the world attention to Gaza and to Hezbollah is to crush the Iranian people, to crush the Iranian opposition. Remember, there was a Mahsa revolution. It was solid. It could not be reversed. The women of Iran were the heroes of it, and the minorities, so on and so forth. So now that they have moved the scenery, the media scenery, to other places, they are butchering these opposition leaders. These are students, lawyers, others, and they are also among them hostages still in Iran. We talk about the hostages in Gaza. There are U.S. nationals, German nationals, sitting in prisons in Iran being tortured. And the regime is requesting $1.5 billion for each one of these, you know, hostages. It's crazy what's happening.
Wow. Well, how should the international community, how should the United States be responding to this?
Well, which United States, if it's the now Biden administration and trying to place now an extension to it through Kamala's administration?
Yeah,
I don't think they can do much because they are part of that transaction. They're the ones sending the billions. So what do you want us to tell them? Stop sending the billions, number one. Mm. And number two, arm Israel. Number three, engage with the Iranian opposition. I mean, a third grader could, but they would not do it. Too much interest.
You know, Waleed, you said, and you repeated it just a moment ago, in October, you told me, of last year, the Iranian regime would use its war against Israel to wage war against its own people. So that is essentially what we're seeing here. It's the purging of any political opposition to quell any future uprising or revolution from within. Is that what you're saying?
You said it better than I do. So next time we're going to co-author a book. You're very good at it.
You don't want to do that.
No, I don't know. No, but that you're absolutely right. That is the essence of the game. So, look, very simple. I'm advising from your show into those who needs to hear. For this administration, they won't hear me. The next administration, I'm telling them, what you do is to engage with the Iranian people from the inside. You don't need to send troops. You don't need to do anything. Mm. Just engage with the opposition. They will topple that region. Period.
Yeah. We are seeing jihadist violence, not only in the Middle East, but in other parts of the world. For example, jihadists in Bangladesh helped stage a coup against the pro-Western government there. Waleed, will this lead to further violence against the Hindu community in Bangladesh? And is ethnic cleansing imminent?
It's happening, yes. I mean, the first wave of an ethnic cleansing is forcing exodus, it's like what the German Nazis have done in the 30s, right? When they started, before the Holocaust, they started to break down, you know, shops and then harass the Jewish community. And then they got to it. This goes back to the irresponsible withdrawal, the way the Biden administration withdrew from Afghanistan. We warned you and I, we warned many times since that year, that if you transfer power to the Taliban, the top jihadists of the world in Afghanistan, it will have ripple effects everywhere. And now we're seeing it in Bangladesh. I mean, those who were behind the real opposition to the secular president and her government are not the students. The students have been manipulated by many people, including the Muslim Brotherhood. I see the arms of the Muslim Brotherhood.
Waleed, I want to get your take on what's happening in the United Kingdom. We have seen there over the last few days horrendous violence. Dozens of towns and cities have violent protests have broken out in the wake of a deadly stabbing attack on a children's dance class in which three girls ages 6 to 9 were killed. Five of them are in critical condition. A 17-year-old Briton, son of Rwandan parents, was charged with the crimes that really sparked this supposed wave of anti-immigrant violence. Now there are accusations that far-right protesters and misinformation are fueling this violence. What do we know about the attacker and the possible motive?
Let me say it in a very quick way. No, no, no. This is not a simple social incident, and then the right wing comes. The right wing is going to come in anyway. You know, once you have organized networks of jihadists, and those networks of jihadists are stirring trouble from Bangladesh all the way to Middle England, what you're going to have is a, what I would say, a natural, not good, but normal reaction by the extremes. Once you play the jihadists, those who are not happy with the immigration in general and don't understand how to distinguish immigration from the jihadists are going to go in and they're going to be accused of themselves triggering the whole issue. They had no problem before the Muslim Brotherhood moved in, before the jihadists moved in. I mean, we have to go back to immediately after 9/11. There were many, many attempts by the jihadists to destabilize Britain. It did not work. Now they have what they call consistent demography, demography of jihadists, and they are using it, and they are adopting the narrative of the woke. See, now it's like the skin is woke, but inside it's basically jihadists. They are in control of the market. And that's why they want to break down the national security of every liberal democracy of every Western country if they can.
By shifting the demographics in these regions.
Absolutely. I mean, when you have an open immigration across the Mediterranean, and we are screaming, pay attention. I delivered a speech to the European Parliament 2015, telling them few years from now, it's not the actual demographics. If these people are coming just to work and be integrated, that's one thing. First, the second, they are illegal, another problem. The worst problem, they are penetrated by jihadists. All these landings on that island in Italy or in the Aegean Sea are organized by the jihadists.
And look, this week in Austria of all places, Taylor Swift had to cancel her planned concerts after the arrest of two young men who were plotting a terrorist attack. One has pledged allegiance to ISIS. This is just what you're talking about. And according to Fox, I quote, officials allege the two young men wanted to kill as many people as possible using knives or self-explosives outside the Ernst Happel Stadium, end quote. This is a global epidemic that we seem to have lost sight of, Waleed. Are all of these conflicts globally related in some way?
Absolutely related, integrated, coordinating. I know people now and maybe in ages in government saying, what is Faris telling us? What I told you, I told your agencies for 10 years. I even gave you slides. I actually projected where it's going to blow up. And it is. It's like a mathematical equation. You bring in jihadists, that's what they're going to do. They're not going to become social Democrats or liberal Democrats or Republicans or Democrats. It is happening now. It's not that it may happen and grow. There are jihadists inside the continent of Europe. There are jihadists inside the United States. We opened full open of a border in the South. What are we talking about? It's not just Marxist and pro-Chinese. An army of jihadists is here. It's embedded itself now with all these protests. I'm not saying the protests are, but these are the covers for the jihadists to operate. I mean, expect more in America.
Wow. Waleed Faris, we will leave it there and be in touch soon. Iran, an imperialist Republican U.S. policy, is available now in bookstores everywhere. Waleed Faris, thank you for the time.
Thank you, Raymond.
She's a longtime advocate for school choice and parental rights, as well as the former U.S. Secretary of Education under Donald Trump. She's here tonight with some grave concerns about Kamala Harris's running mate, Governor Tim Walz of Minnesota. Please welcome back to the program, Betsy DeVos. Betsy, thanks for being here. Earlier this week, you sounded the alarm over Minnesota Governor Tim Walz being added to the Democratic ticket. because Randy Weingarten, the head of the teachers union, showered him with praise. Here's what she had to say.
Tim Walz is Kamala Harris's choice for vice president. We're so excited. He's a teacher. He's a union member. We have known him for years as a social studies teacher, as a vet, as a union member, as a congressman, as a governor. He cares about working people.
You see this as a cause for concern, Randy Weingarten's excitement over this candidacy. Why, Betsy?
Well, anyone about whom Randy Weingarten is as excited as she appears to be should be terrifying to parents and students, because Randy Weingarten has not been a friend of students. She has done nothing but preclude students from getting their best and doing their best and being their best because of all of the policies she has advocated for. The notion of her having the same kind of unfettered access to the Oval Office that she has clearly had in the Biden administration should also be terrifying. Just think of the implications of her influence having kept schools shut down, closed down way, way, way beyond when they should have during COVID, and really impacting all kinds of policies that directly impact students in the classrooms in a negative way. It's really concerning about what this could mean if the Kamala Harris and Tim Walz ticket is successful.
Well, Secretary DeVos, Governor Walz, according to Becky Pringle, who's the NEA president, she claims he's the education governor, that he's brought free tuition to low-income families, abortion rights to the state constitution. He adamantly has opposed school vouchers. Is he the education governor in your estimation?
Well, no, the policies that he's advocated for, including precluding taking sexually explicit books and materials out of libraries for young children, including making Minnesota a sanctuary place for students to come and permanently mutilate themselves without parental consent for gender change. All of these things accrue to one of the most liberal and far left leaning governors that we could ever have imagined. And being on the ticket with someone like Kamala, the San Francisco liberal, the two of them together should be a very, very concerning combination for parents and kids.
Well, you mentioned, look, he was one of the governors on the forefront of keeping schools closed and churches closed to people of faith throughout the COVID epidemic. And as you mentioned a moment ago, he signed a bill making Minnesota a refuge, a sanctuary for any child seeking sex change operations. And the parents really have no role in this. I want to play this bite. This is Lee Fink. This is an advisor to Governor Walz. Just listen.
You have said that Governor Walz has shown up for your community. You are the first out transgender legislator in Minnesota history. What did you mean by that? Expand on it a little bit.
Yes, of course. You know, when we elected 11 new LGBTQ members to the House 2 years ago and created the Queer Caucus, and I started pushing the importance of the trans refuge bill that I carried, he was always right there. He understood that this is a way for us to help community members, to help people who are different.
What do you make of this as a parent, as an advocate for students and parents?
Well, this is not protecting kids, and it's not doing the best thing for kids. It's really cleaving children from their parents and denying the fact that parents are their child's first and most important educators, not to mention they're the ones who love them more than anyone else could possibly. And so this notion that he is an education governor is very, very a big fallacy. And I hope that people will pay attention to the policies that he really has continued to promulgate in Minnesota. And, you know, you think about Minnesotans and who they've been represented by before. His policies and his positions actually make Al Franken, former senator there, look very normal in comparison.
No, it's a remarkable state of affairs. And Secretary DeVos, you know this political scene and the Midwest better than anybody. My question is this: with only 90 days, and this is probably the shortest presidential contest we've seen in maybe forever, certainly in the last 100 years or so. My question is, are we focused on the wrong things? And how critical is this educational policy? And given what we know of Kamala Harris, of Biden, and of Trump, how do you see this race squaring? And will we focus on education policy, which is so important to the future, maybe one of the most important topics going into this election?
Well, I think education has, in the last several years, become a much more important topic, primarily because parents were exposed to how the school system handled themselves during COVID, and they saw firsthand the many, many shortcomings and the failings of the system. So we've seen advocacy for change. We've seen policy change in state after state. That said, the economy and the border are going to continue to be the uppermost issues in people's minds. But education and the future really, you know, the future of our country really does hinge on how we prepare the next generation. And I think more and more people have begun to realize this. So this is an issue that we need to be paying attention to. And I thank you, people like you, for calling attention to the positions of the candidates on these very important topics. And Governor Waltz is very far from an advocate for families and for students based on the policies he's put in place in Minnesota.
Secretary Betsy DeVos, thank you for being here. Hostages No More, The Fight for Education Freedom and the Future of the American Child by Betsy DeVos is available at bookstores everywhere and online. Thank you for being here.
Thanks so much, Raymond.
He is the CEO of Schwartz Investment Counsel, portfolio manager of the Ave Maria Mutual Funds, and author of In God We Trust, Morally Responsible Investing. He's here tonight to discuss the current state of the U.S. economy, high inflation, those interest rates, and more. Please welcome back to the program George Schwartz. George, earlier this week, the Dow dropped over 1,000 points, rattling Wall Street and the world markets. The S&P had its worst day in 2 years, dropping 3%. NASDAQ did the same. George, what's driving these wild gyrations in the U.S. market?
Well, as you and I have talked about many times, Raymond, the stock market does not like uncertainty. There are a tremendous number of uncertainties at the present time around the world and at home here. But that's causing volatility. One of the issues that doesn't get enough attention, I don't think, is the Middle East right now. Of course, there's been talk of maybe the war is going to escalate and Iran's going to invade Israel or vice versa. But that is got the potential, in my mind, of being a significant problem for our economy and especially the stock market.
Yeah.
There's no one what the effect it'll have on the stock market if a big war breaks out.
Before the U.S. markets took a tumble, the Asian markets were trembling. And we watched, you know, they had a, whatever, 12% decline. Even Warren Buffett selling some of his tech stocks, including Apple, were blamed for the dip. Is any of that credible, that presaged and is tied to the U.S. market?
Yes, the Asian market's tied to the U.S. market, particularly the Mag 7 stocks, the big industrial mega cap high-tech companies. The speculators, especially hedge funds, have been borrowing money in a cheap currency, the yuan, converting it to dollars and buying U.S. stocks, particularly the Magnificent Seven. When interest rates rose in Japan, that whole trade had to be unwound and resulted in panic selling. The other thing that is panicky, at least according to my friends on Wall Street, is the upcoming election for president.
Aha.
They are in a panic state that Kamala Harris may become our next president, God forbid.
And you think that's what the sell-off is about, partially, the worry that you might have a continuation of the Biden years?
Yeah, or the Obama years, if you want to call it that. But she's got currently, it would appear, she's got the money and the momentum and the media all in her favor. And I get a kick out of the media that I think is trying to turn her into something she's not. But the very liberal media is what the Wall Street Journal called doing a transfiguration of Kamala, trying to turn her into a combination of Helen of Troy and Margaret Thatcher. But she's not the, and then, of course, as you well know, in the last week or two, she's started to outpoll President Trump, even in a couple of the swing states where he was leading by several percentage points.
Yeah.
So it's scary. And if that continues, or that trend, her recent strength continues, and hopefully it won't, but the Wall Street people I know could turn into a full panic mode and do significant selling.
Okay, well, tell me, with all this uncertainty we're seeing, and I've spoken to a number of economists, they are saying the R word again, George. What do you think we're about to see as far as a recession is concerned? Are we on the precipice of a recession?
We could be, but the for the moment, the economy remains relatively strong. And that's not because of Biden and Kamala, but in spite of them, in spite of Biden's policies, which have been detrimental in so many respects.
But George, how can you say this economy is strong? We have a debt ratio. I saw something the other day where we're paying off like 76% of every tax dollar accrued is paid out in interest on our debt. That seems like a very wobbly and unstable government and underlying economy to me.
Yeah, and that's one of the things that could push us into a recession, the long anticipated recession. But for the moment, corporate profits remain very strong.
Yeah.
And that's buoying the stock market.
Yeah.
That could change quickly, of course, but for the time being, corporate profits are very strong.
This volatility in the market has placed a lot of pressure on Fed Chairman Jerome Powell to cut interest rates sooner rather than later. As Americans begin to feel the pinch on loans and mortgages and credit card rates, high inflation and prices continue to be a source of anxiety, George. Do you see the Fed cutting those rates anytime soon?
Yes, they'll probably be doing it in the month of September. They should have done it last month.
Hmm.
But there are signs of recession that could be developing. They're not real strong right now, but our friend Larry Kudlow has opined that we could be on the cusp of a recession. Again, the long anticipated recession, or the long predicted recession.
Hmm.
And inflation will be a problem if Kamala Harris becomes president, because she will continue the spending, reckless spending of the Biden administration, and that's going to keep inflation strong and probably stop interest rates from dropping as much as they could under the Fed's leadership.
You think a piece of that then is tied the inflationary rate we're seeing and the pressures on the economy? You see that tied to the $2 trillion plus in federal spending that was pushed out the door in these infrastructure packages, et cetera?
Exactly right, Raymond, yes. Spending has been reckless and out of control for quite some time now.
Okay, I want to talk about investing for a moment before we run out of time. An investment strategy, George. The market obviously is in flux. A lot of people are terrified about losing what they've already got invested in their 401ks. Others are just as terrified about getting into the market at all. What should they justify? What should these justifiably skittish potential investors be thinking? What should be their posture? Should they stay out of the market now?
No, let's stay out of the market. The first rule of investing is diversification. Not have all your eggs in one basket. So investors should be diversified, and they should be long-term oriented. That's the second most important thing, being long-term oriented. And I've been preaching, as you know, for years, to not try to outguess the near-term swings in the market, because they're unpredictable, and they're almost unpredictable. And most of the time, it's a waste of time trying to trying to say what the next quarter is going to look like or what the next 6 months is going to look like in terms of the economy or the stock market.
Mm-hmm. George, you talked about Kamala Harris and Joe Biden's record. Should Trump return to office, what do you think we could be in the market of seeing here from economic policy? Obviously, he's promised energy independence. He wants to lower regulations. He wants to put tariffs on China, the goods we trade to China, and vice versa. Where will that put us in an economic forecast?
Well, he can do an awful lot of good if he returns to office, and including unwinding some of the regulations that Trump has put in place, unwinding this trillion-dollar climate package
that Biden put in place.
But the economy could likely be a lot stronger. But one of the things that we've got to be careful of under a new Trump administration is the tariffs. And he's very proud of the fact that he's the tariff man. But those, in my view, can be very destructive to the U.S. economy. The tariffs are not paid for by foreign governments or foreign companies. They're really paid for by the U.S. consumers. So I think that's a spot that I hope Biden can get better advice on. Trump can get better advice on.
Okay. George, before we go, you and the Ave Maria Funds made some headlines earlier this year. You won something called the Lipper Award, which is a prestigious honor given to outstanding investment performance to individual funds. Which of your funds won this and why? Why do you think?
Well, that was the Ave Maria Bond Fund. Here's the award right here from Lipper. It's the best fund for 3 years, 5 years, and 10 years. And we're very proud of it. And the bond fund has had a terrific track record for the 20 years of its existence. And I'm very happy and proud to report on that. And thanks for bringing it up.
Okay, well, now I know where I have to move some of my cash, because everywhere else I'm dying here, George. We'll leave it there. In God We Trust, Morally Responsible Investing by George Schwartz is available at bookstores everywhere. Find out more about the Ave Maria Mutual Funds at AveMariaFunds.com. Thank you, George.
Thank you, Raymond.
Sean Cardinal O'Malley has served as Archbishop of Boston since 2003. He just turned 80, and having reached that milestone, Pope Francis accepted his resignation. Bishop Richard Henning of Providence, Rhode Island, has been named as the new Archbishop of Boston, taking possession of the see on October 31st. But who is Bishop Henning? And what will be the legacy of Cardinal Sean O'Malley? Here with analysis, Boston native and editor of Catholic World News, Philip Lawler. Phil, thanks for being here. I want to get your take on this appointment. As soon as this news broke, what do you make of the appointment of Bishop Henning of Providence, where he only served for a year, and now he's going to this historic archdiocese?
It was a bit of a surprise to me, because I know very little about Bishop Henning. What little I know, I have to say, is favorable. I had heard a few months ago that Cardinal O'Malley would be replaced by someone from Rockville Center, the Diocese of Rockville Center, New York. And I assumed that meant the Bishop of Rockville Center. Bishop Henning is a native of Rockville Center, so yeah. I guess the message was lost in translation. Or possibly something happened in Rockville Center, such as the diocese went bankrupt, and that might have altered things. I don't know.
Yeah, well, I mean, O'Malley, we should point out, was also Bishop of Palm Beach for a very short period of time before he was whisked to Boston. So there's a pattern of this. But there were reports, Phil, and I'd love your reaction to this, that Cardinal Wuerl, the former and disgraced Archbishop of Washington, and Cardinal Supich personally went to Rome to lobby the Pope to move Cardinal Robert McElroy of San Diego to Boston. What do you think happened there, and why do you think that suggestion was rejected by the Pope?
Cardinal McElroy is clearly one of the Pope's men. That's why he's a cardinal, although still waiting for a metropolitan archdiocese. And these two are the cardinal's men. Cardinals Supich and Wuerl, both created as cardinals by Pope Francis, both in line with his liberal theology and ideology, so they wanted one of their own in Boston. I think, and I'm given to understand, that Cardinal O'Malley was opposed to that suggestion. That doesn't mean we're out of the woods, because there's an opening soon coming in the Archdiocese of Washington where Cardinal McElroy might find himself very welcome.
Wow. Yeah. And New York comes up next year as well, the top of next year. So there's a lot of turmoil in these seas. But Phil, Henning is only 59 years old. He himself was reportedly shocked by the appointment. What have you heard from others about Henning? What kind of shepherd do you think he'll be? You mentioned Rockville Center. He was an auxiliary in Rockville Center, we should say.
Right. A priest and then an auxiliary, and then he was moved to Providence. And as you say, has been there really a fairly short time. All I can say is Providence is down the street from Boston, and friends in Providence think highly of him. He has been supportive of the Catholic tradition there. He has been really a listening bishop, which he's promised to be in Boston. And he succeeded Bishop Tobin, who was a relatively conservative bishop there and didn't make any enemies. So I don't think that he will be a firebrand one way or another, but the indications that I have are, relatively favorable.
Yeah, I spoke to someone who met the cardinal, knew him a little bit, or the soon-to-be cardinal, Bishop Henning, and said they were impressed by his fidelity to the teaching of the church, the traditional teaching of the church, and his defense of it. So that's a good sign. Phil, who were the candidates that you imagined might replace Cardinal Sean? And why is this pick so out of left field, do you think, when, you know, Pope Francis has chosen bishops who sort of share his vision and personal approach to church teaching?
That's a really good question. Frankly, I expected someone along those lines, someone more of a Pope Francis archbishop for Boston. And to be honest with you, such an archbishop would be fairly well received by most of the clergy in Boston and most of the dwindling congregations in Boston. Mm. So I expected a hard line, Francis Archbishop. I didn't know who the candidates were. I was also worried about Archbishop McElroy, and my friends in Rome told me fairly early on I shouldn't worry so much. Maybe I would have worried more if I'd known there were cardinals flying over to Rome to lobby for me.
Yeah, well, that's what the report said anyway. And Henning is a sacred theologian. He speaks Italian, Spanish, a big plus given the growing Hispanic population in Boston.
Yes.
But Phil, given what you've heard and read about Henning in the last week or so, do you think he'll be more of a pastor or an administrator? And which role is most needed in Boston now?
That's a very good question. I think from what I've heard, and I may be wrong, I think he'll be more of a pastor. He doesn't strike me as a sort of man who will plant himself behind a desk. And the fact that he said right away at his first press conference in Boston that he planned to spend the first year listening and learning about the Archdiocese, that speaks more to me as a pastor, because, boy, does this Archdiocese of Boston need an administrator. It is in big trouble, has been in big trouble for a very long time.
Okay, well, this is a good place to end our interview, Phil. Reflect on the tenure of Cardinal Sean O'Malley. What do you think will be his lasting legacy in Boston?
He is going to go down as the archbishop who came in at a time when the archdiocese was demoralized by the sex abuse crisis, and he did successfully at least get it out of the headlines. I won't say it's cured, because it hasn't been cured. When he came into this city, Boston, the church in Boston was in free fall. 20 years later, he's leaving, and I'm afraid the church is still in free fall. The dwindling mass attendance, the budget that's out of balance or balanced only by the sale of real estate from parishes that are closing. We have a lot of work to catch up with in Boston.
Wow. Well, blessings to the new Archbishop Henning as he takes on that responsibility. And we'll leave it there. Catholic World News editor Philip Lawler's reporting and commentary can be found at CatholicCulture.org. Thank you, Phil. That is all the time we have. Until next week, we will be scouting the world over for all that is seen and unseen. On behalf of the staff and crew of EWTN News, thanks for watching. I'm Raymond Arroyo. Bye now.